thank you very much for sharing the results of the preliminary survey and giving us a sense of the number, the wide variety of world regions where universities are working, and the extraordinary number of projects and style of kind of expertise and initiative that is being carried out. What I want to do now is turn over to our panel for a discussion, a little more of an in-depth discussion on the kinds of projects the universities are carrying out, the nature of those partnerships, the ways in which information is shared, and to share some thoughts on the ways in which universities and the public sector may better be able to engage on international water sanitation and hygiene issues. So before I get started, let me just introduce our panelists to you. You have the biographical material along with the agenda that you picked up here, but kind of, I guess, going from the end to the going from down there to here, and we tried to get a little gender balance here by dispersing. We didn't mean to cluster a whole group of women here at the end. So, right, yeah, this isn't reflective of any particular estate end of any sort. Michael Campana on the far end is professor of hydrogeology and water resources at Oregon State University in the Department of Geosciences. David Sabatini is the David Ross Boyd Professor and director of the Water Center at the University of Oklahoma College of Engineering. Jenna Davis is Assistant Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering and a Fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University. And David Kramer is Professor of Hydrology at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. And I skipped Kellogg, I'm so sorry. Kellogg Schwab is, last but not least, Kellogg Schwab is Associate Professor and the Director of the Center for Water and Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. So, what I want to do is start by asking each of the panelists to get a little more specific and to share with us an example of their research from the field to demonstrate both the unique contributions that universities can make in addressing WASH challenges and to talk a bit about how the partnerships with institutions in country develop and how the results of the work in countries may have implications both for policy making and for programming. And so I think what I'll do is ask the panelists, we'll start with David Kramer and move toward the end of the panel. But let me just ask you to say a few words about the nature of the projects, to tell us about a specific project and the kind of partnerships that you're engaging in.
Sure. Thank you for inviting us all here. The type of projects that the University of Nevada system is involved in are very varied. There's something called the West African Water Initiative, which goes from the basics of doing geophysical work to locate wells and to help put those wells in. That's funded by several sources. There's student groups that raise their own money that go over and put wells in communities where they actually drill the wells by hand and teach people how to drill wells when they've left, and so it can continue on in these rural communities. They asked us to pick one project, and so the one I'd like to mention, I've been involved in a lot of lectures at different universities throughout the developing world, and one lecture I recently gave was through the Civilian Research and Development Foundation. It was in Iraq, and the purpose of the program that they have is to train weapon scientists or people who have the potential to be weapon scientists to be environmental scientists. This sort of activity helps the security of the world. I want to point out, though, that all the other activities you'll be hearing about, the person-to-person contact of students going over and doing projects on all sorts of scales, really adds to the view of what we are as a country abroad, and also adds to the security of our nation as well by this person-to-person contact as we do these projects.
Great. Thank you, this opportunity. My name is Kellogg Schwab. I'm at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. I'm director of the Center for Water and Health there. And I'm also part of a consortium at Johns Hopkins that we just started, the Global Water Program, which is integrating in researchers not only from the School of Public Health and the Whiting School of Engineering, some of the classic components to some of these questions here, but also incorporating in behavioral specialists from the Center for Communication Programs at Johns Hopkins, policy from the School for Advanced International Studies at SAIS, economics from arts and sciences, and then also technology from Applied Physics Laboratory as we integrate this into these complex issues here. But I thought I'd like to stop for a second and say, who here likes indoor plumbing? Let me tell you, it is a wonderful thing to be able to go take a cool drink of water from any place you want in the United States and be reasonably sure you're not going to die in a couple days. It's also a nice thing to be able to defecate in a toilet and have that be very close by. Well, most of the world does not have this luxury. And for those who say, I don't worry about tap water, I say, did you brush your teeth this morning? And if you said yes, I would say, what type of water did you use? And most people do not use bottled water, brush their teeth in the United States. We take things for granted here in the U.S. But what we have here at Hopkins is that we're involved in over 60 countries around the world, and that we're also involved in projects gone on for 40 years. Some of them in Bangladesh have been working there for cholera. The components that are in on this are quite complex. Some of the studies we're working on include advanced drinking water treatment processes, and this involves membrane technology that we're working on both for domestic and international. Point of use, so household use of treated water at the household level. And this could both be for microbial and chemical contaminants. These from simple clay pots all the way up to more advanced technologies. Evaluation of what we call small water enterprises. These would be decentralized water systems that would be at the community level. So bringing water to communities where they don't have a centralized water system in there. And we're also developing water testing, kits that we can actually leave on site around the world so people can monitor the water and send it back telemetry to places that could be monitoring this over periods of time. So we don't just get one small snapshot, we get an understanding of the water for long periods of time. And then also evaluation of the human behavior and the drivers that cause people to choose the water selection. What I'd like to do is talk just very briefly on one project that we're involved with. And this was actually a little bit different. This was a project that was put on together by a philanthropic group that is funding a for-profit company that's going overseas to provide water at the community level for rural populations, for poor populations. And this for-profit company is designing it where they want to incorporate in an understanding of the community itself and have the community be vested into these projects for water. This is for potable water, but also education and sanitation and hygiene in there. And what our part at Johns Hopkins was, is to go in and do an independent assessment. One of the goals at Hopkins is do no harm, to make sure that what's been going on is not going to harm the individuals, but we wanted to give an assessment to see what was an appropriate way or was it being done right. And we did this evaluation there where we looked at a system of surveys. We actually tested the water ourselves at these things, and we also did focus groups. And the water system that was developed was a kiosk level. People would come to get the water, and they'd go to their homes. And we found that this company actually could provide high-quality water. The source water is contaminated. The water that the company was providing was of quite good quality, but it got immediately recontaminated. When we looked at the household level, the water was contaminated with microorganisms. So the quality of water was degrading over time. So the education part of it was lacking in many instances. So we reported this back and communicated to us. So the understanding we have here is that it's not simple at all. We have technology that can provide water, but how you implement it and how you educate people is a challenge. And one of the things we're working on is trying to develop these systems to go forward to try to make this a scalable and sustainable method that can then be implemented in other places of the world.
Let's see.
Well, thanks very much. So like Kellogg, I would say that the Stanford WASH community is interested in a lot of these issues that are at the interface of the technology and the users. We often say if this were just a technical solution, it would have been solved by now. And so we are working also in a number of communities and on a variety of topics, but the one project I wanted to share with you is actually looking at an iterative relationship between research and practice and back to research. So, you know, the received wisdom about why we have this persistent lack or gap in access to water and sanitation services includes sort of obviously poverty, that people are just too poor to access these services. But for any of us who have spent any time in a developing country, you start to notice that there's an awful lot of money changing hands, particularly around water. And if you start to unpack actually what low-income households are paying, it's quite a lot. So my family gets to enjoy about 1,000 liters of water for about a dollar and a half, and it's delivered into our homes and it's safe. And in India, where this project took place, the households that we were speaking to were paying 4 to 6 times that amount for water that was not nearly as safe as the water my family gets to enjoy, and it had to be fetched and carried from a distance, from a public tap in the neighborhood. And so when you start to add up the amount of money that they were spending, they could easily have afforded a higher level of service, but they didn't have one. So the question, or the puzzle then, from a research, applied research perspective, is why not? What's the problem here? Why can't we jump up to a higher level of service? Now, if you or I wanted to make a big home improvement like that, we would deal with this challenge through credit. Right, we take a loan, we would go ahead and install an in-home connection or an in-home toilet, and then we pay back our lender over time. But low-income households often don't have this opportunity. So the hypothesis emerged from applied research that perhaps this idea of microfinance, which is so popular and so successful in the area of small business development, could be leveraged or thought about in the context of WASH. So in partnership with a U.S.-based NGO, it's already been mentioned here before, water.org, we've been carrying out research on a program of theirs called Water Credit. And Water Credit pairs in-country NGOs with water utilities and microfinance institutions with banks, and tries to facilitate a relationship here that allows households who do have the means to access higher levels of water and sanitation service. And it's a relatively new program. It's been in existence for just a few years. But to date, more than 130,000 people have acquired in-home water connections and or in-home toilets through microfinance.
Thank you. Dave Sabatino, University of Oklahoma, Director of the Water Center, Water Technologies for Emerging Regions, Bringing Water and Sanitation to Remote Villages. And within that center, we're looking at water resources, climate change issues, drinking water quality issues, and treatment wetlands, water reuse issues. We focus on developing countries, but also seeing how those topics apply to rural parts of Oklahoma. And my particular work is in the drinking water quality side of things, looking at arsenic and fluoride. It turns out after pathogens, arsenic and fluoride, the World Health Organization has identified as the top drinking water quality issues in developing countries, and these are issues we can relate to in Oklahoma because we have naturally occurring arsenic actually in my home, in this Norman, Oklahoma, the home of the University of Oklahoma, as well as fluoride issues. So as part of our efforts, we have a cooperative graduate program in Chua Longhorn University in Bangkok, Thailand. I go there each summer and I teach for 2 weeks, half a semester course. Thai faculty teaches 2 weeks the remainder of the semester, and work with graduate students in the pilot program. But someone told me, well, while you're in Thailand, you should go next door to Cambodia. There's a NGO there, Resource Development International Cambodia. And so I visited there and found out it was actually a stellar, shining example of an NGO making a positive impact in Cambodia. And they struggle with arsenic in the naturally occurring arsenic in the groundwater. So I started working with graduate students on developing simple technologies, taking local materials, processing them using local technologies to produce adsorbents that could be used to remove the arsenic from the drinking water. In this way, as opposed to shipping materials from the U.S. or Europe to Cambodia, we can produce those materials locally, promote microfinance businesses, help promote the economic development, as well as address the water quality issues. As part of that also, that collaboration with my colleagues in Thailand, we're working to, I teach when I'm in Cambodia, to try and improve the educational opportunities of those students so that they're able to compete in graduate programs in Thailand, or eventually our goal would be that they may go to Bangkok for their master's and then come to Oklahoma for their PhD. I don't have time to talk about what we're doing, a similar type of an activity in Ethiopia, and there the focus is on fluoride and natural occurring fluoride in the Rift Valley area of Ethiopia. Fluoride is interesting because we add fluoride to our water in the United States to improve teeth quality, but at much higher levels it becomes negative for health. And so we're working with the Universities of Addis Ababa Chemistry Department, as well as two Ethiopian NGOs, PSI Ethiopia and CRS Ethiopia.
Michael Campana.
Thank you, Catherine. Pleasure to be here today. I'm going to talk about, in fact, some of the pictures that are coming up on the screens. The ones from Honduras and Panama relate to a project that I started a number of years ago. And this was essentially to bring American graduate students down to Honduras to help villagers build rural water systems and sanitation systems. And it got started, again, like all most good things, it was serendipity, dumb luck, whatever. I was down there in 2000 doing work for an NGO as a volunteer, and I was taken up to one of these remote villages where a young man, or Hondureño, was actually teaching people how to build systems, water systems, etc. And I said a little bit too loudly, but I was just kind of commenting to myself, boy, I'd love to take my students down to do this kind of stuff. So the translator immediately translated it to the people, and essentially it came out like, this gringo wants to bring his students down here this summer. So I gotta go vote now?
Okay. Is that right?
No. Anyway, so I did. I went back and I raised some money and brought, for 5 years running, brought some graduate students down who were part of an interdisciplinary water resources program, and this served as their capstone field course. And so what they did was they didn't build the systems, they helped the villagers build the systems. They worked in the villages, we slept in the villages, we helped them cook, etc. We also taught them about hygiene and sanitation, source water protection. I mean, if you build a water system, but then you let your cattle go up by the spring and everything, that's not a good sign. We partnered not only with the local people, but with SANA, which is a Spanish acronym. It was the Honduran government agency that was responsible for rural water and sanitation. And we all had to sign an agreement that we were going to do certain things, and God knows what I committed my university to, because I didn't know very much Spanish then. But anyway, in terms of programmatic and policy effects, unlike some of these programs, it didn't really have a lot, but I remember one story in particular I'll relate. I think I have a few minutes left, or a minute or so left, is we were standing around one day, not standing around, we were trying to put in a foundation for a 5,000-gallon water tank for the village. It was a hot day, and there was no division of labor among our men and women. We all did the same thing. They busted the rocks, the men busted the rocks, everything. And we noticed that we were doing this by a school, and the kids came out on the break, and of course they segregated into men and women, boys and girls. And we noticed that they were looking at us and chattering away, you know, kind of animatedly. So I didn't know much Spanish then, even less than I know now, so I asked my friend, I said, I know something's going on here. They're kind of amazed, aren't they? And he said, yeah, they're amazed because the men and the women are doing the same work, and there's no, okay, girls, you stand to the side and stuff like that. So I immediately thought, and was trying to be politically correct, I said, Rolando, I said, aren't we screwing these people up? He says, no, we're not screwing these people up. He said, these girls need to see that they have options. They can do anything the guys can do, and the guys have to see that too. And so after that, I kept my mouth shut. And actually, in that same village a couple of years later, I went back to see if the things were still working. It was. The system was working, and of course, the women in those societies, like in many developing countries, the women and the girls have the responsibility for collecting the water. Well, the women had been free of this responsibility. They started going cash crops. herbs and spices, so they were actually making money in the village. And I said to my friend, I looked at Rolando, and before I could say anything, he said, "They're not. You didn't screw them up." He said, "They need to be doing this." He said, "The women have become empowered." So that's one of the things that really stuck with me. And actually, SANA, the organization, after our work there, they decided, "Hey, these gringos can be helpful without coming in and, you know, screwing the people up." So we had a pretty good effect, and I think the two systems out of the five that we built that are not functioning were the fault actually of the Honduran agency, because they forgot to send their circuit riders around every 6 months. That was part of the deal to help make these things sustainable. So anyway, and about of the 75 students I took down, about 10 or 15 actually went into international development work, and some actually were turned down there to do their theses in particular areas in Honduras and, you know, more research type things. So that's my 3 cents.
Thank you. A number of the panelists have mentioned, you know, conducting research in countries and working with partners within a variety of different sectors, within ministries, within universities. And I wanted to ask a couple of you to say a little bit about the ways that the results from these projects get shared in the host countries and how they get shared internationally. So and also some of you have mentioned that you didn't know, you know, that other academic institutions were doing research in the same country. So I guess I would add, how do you share information with each other on the kind of WASH activities that you're engaged in? And so let me ask Kellogg and Jenna to say, you know, a few words about some of the work. I know, Kellogg, you were talking about the work in Ghana. Jenna has been willing to discuss some of the work on models of small water systems in some of the countries where she's worked. And, you know, just tell us a little bit about how the information gets shared and what are the lessons or benefits that can be more broadly disseminated.
Certainly. If I focus just on that one project I described in Ghana, one of the important issues here is that we didn't just take the information and go back to Johns Hopkins and that was the end of it. We actually were quite aggressive in trying to communicate our findings, even preliminary findings, this is going on. One of the things we did was go back to each village. But these were rural villages in Ghana that were getting these systems put in place, and we communicated back to the villagers themselves what our findings were. So direct involvement to the community to help empower them, to let them understand that even clean water that they acquire from a site can get recontaminated in their home, to allow them to understand that this is a process that they must be aware of. And also one of the things we were doing is trying to communicate in a broader sense to the area around Ghana. There was a project, this is an ongoing project, and one of our goals is to have the Ghanaian School of Public Health in Accra be involved in this. And students are going to go out with us when we go back there this summer. And we're developing a workshop where we're integrating in both education of the School of Public Health, the students and faculty, but also the local communities. We're getting the government to be involved in this in a workshop type of format where we try to disseminate not just these findings in those single villages, but also communication, as we went out and you heard before, about the critical need of sanitation in addition to providing just potable water. Another example that I'll cite this very briefly is that, for example, the Center for Communication Programs is working quite strongly with government organizations, and they are working in Indonesia, for example, and what they're doing is not just talking to the government about the one aspect of water, but they're including it into a series of communications with the government to empower the government themselves. It's almost going countrywide, that it's not just potable water, but it's hand washing with appropriate soap. It's the concern about open defecation. It's the concern of wastewater treatment and also solid waste. All these things combined together to allow them to understand these are critical needs that must be put together, and the communication is involved in that.
So I just want to underscore something that Kellogg just said, which is that their team returns to the communities and feeds that information back to them. That is not easy to do. It would be much easier to take the data and run. And so I just want to applaud that and say that I think that everyone here on the panel is very sincere in thinking about that aspect of the work that they do. And it's not all that common, though. And I think it's very important. And so similarly, we are interested in our research projects at thinking about what kinds of information different audiences could benefit from, and then there's the whole challenge of packaging it. So We do a lot of work in our research group on the problem of rural water sustainability. So at any given moment, at this moment in time, depending on whose study you believe, between a third and 40% of the hand pumps currently installed in sub-Saharan Africa are not working. And it's not that they've reached the end of their useful life, they've failed prematurely. And so so when we do a piece of work, for example, in Kenya or in Mozambique, then we have some local audiences, we have local stakeholders that we want to be sure to share results with. So those would be the communities. They're also the Ministry of Water and Irrigation. They could be utilities themselves. They could be water service boards. But something that I've seen in the course of my experience in international development and water is that you really want the ear of the Ministry of Finance, right? Because a lot of the challenges that you're identifying and talking with about people in the water sector are well known to them, and they need more resources to deal with them. So if you can think about the way to package your evidence, your findings, your research, to make an economic case for either better, smarter investment or more investment in water and sanitation and hygiene, then you can probably have a lot greater impact at that country level. Then scaling up from there, regional workshops are critical. The statistic I gave you was a sub-Saharan African statistic. You know, there are variations from country to country, but the other thing that I think is a shame is that we identify and reinvent the wheel and reanalyze these problems again and again and again because we have these isolated research communities that are working in different places. So I really applaud the effort that CSIS and everyone here has put into the survey and trying to create some momentum around a research community, at least in the United States. OU is now having a conference every other year. Chapel Hill is doing that too. You know, there are new centers, so there's a lot of movement, which is terrific. But as academics, you know, at the end of the day, we're looking at academic conferences and international conferences for our products, and we need to remember that a lot of the impact on the ground is going to come from strategic packaging of findings.
Thank you both very much. A recurring theme that has come up in a number of the discussions, including the presentation of the survey, was the importance of training the next generation of water, sanitation, and hygiene specialists, both in the United States and elsewhere. And I wanted to ask Dave Sabatini and Michael Campana to say a few words about the importance of that. Why is that important? Are WASH specialists relatively few in number? Is there, you know, a dearth of interest or enthusiasm about participating in WASH classes in universities? And also, could you say something about, you know, the skill sets that need to be developed in order to ensure the sustainability of a strong cadre of WASH expertise internationally, here and internationally?
Okay. Thank you, Catherine. I'm not sure. We heard from Christine that Emory and Georgia Tech have a program changing WASH specialists. I don't know how many other programs there are in the country specifically oriented towards that. I suspect they're relatively few. I don't see that universities need to do much to attract people into these fields. Speaking for myself, and I'm sure for some of the other academics here, we get plenty of interest from students who want to come specifically to work in developing countries on water, sanitation, hygiene, and related issues that perhaps aren't directly related to WASH. So I don't have a problem. My problem is turning students away, and, you know, they'll say, well, don't go there because there's no room. But there are a lot of enthusiastic, bright students out there. One of the skill set I think that's important, and I suspect Dave will say the same thing, is that we need to get people to think, to realize that you need a variety of disciplines to do this kind of work, okay? You need engineers, you need sociologists, you need anthropologists, you need public, all kinds. Now, that doesn't mean that in such a program we would take engineers and train them to turn them into sociologists or vice versa. What you need to do is give people an appreciation for all the other disciplines involved and also a little bit about the jargon and of the other disciplines and the importance as well. And I think for those of us who are water people, we have to do that anyway, whether we're doing WASH stuff or watershed management or groundwater development or whatever. So I think it's important to give them, let them work, or have them work together in multi and interdisciplinary teams. We need to get people
accustomed to working with limited resources. Here in the U.S., we're blessed. You know, there's an 800 number, they'll FedEx a part to you the next day, et cetera. And as we all know, you don't have that in developing countries. You actually have to maybe fabricate things or jury-rig things or something like that. So they have to be able to deal with limited resources. And as has been mentioned, we need to get them to think in terms of sustainability. It's easy to be sustainable in the U.S. because there's always someone around to help you to keep things going. But when you're in a developing country and you're training people, you're trying to get them to the level where they can maintain their own systems, then you have to think about, well, how is it sustainable in a country where they don't have access to all the resources that we do? And I have several stories about engineering students who just went nuts when they went to Honduras because they got to actually do things that they didn't get to do in the U.S. because they had computers and all kinds of other stuff, but they had to sit down with a pen and a calculator and a few other things to actually design systems, okay? The last thing I would mention is that I think these are important because not only will we empower other people to solve their own problems, and that's really what we're trying to do here, we have to avoid the so-called feel-good aspect of this, okay? When you come back from these trips, everybody feels good, okay? And that's fine, but did we actually empower or help the other people feel good when we were down there? Because if we didn't do that, we might as well not be doing this at all. And my feeling is that we'll create, on both sides, us and them, if you will, we're going to create better people because they'll be working with other people. And I think even if the students that we train in the U.S. or in other countries don't work in the WASH area, they're going to be better people for it because of this broad perspective. So, sir?
Just follow up on your last point, I think there'll be better engineering scientists in the U.S. because they'll have a greater appreciation of the broader aspects of their work. And I think it's maybe easier to recognize in a developing country context, but then it may cause the students to reflect and say, what surprises are there at home that I don't know about? In terms of the quality students, I agree. I think the talented students that are attracted to this area are very heartwarming. Two of my current graduate students working in this area received NSF graduate fellowships, and that's a very prestigious award and just an indication of the caliber of the students that are attracted to this. But I think it's a new paradigm, and this has been mentioned before. We can't do the things status quo. We need to approach things. Christine spoke to that well, and I think that we really need to expose the students to the interface, as Jenna mentioned, the interface between disciplines in a way that we haven't had to do in the past. And for us at OU, that means we're trying to work closely with anthropology and with sociology, with business, and with many disciplines to get the students right. This semester we're co-teaching a course in social entrepreneurship with the business college, focused on water and sanitation in developing countries, and getting engineering and business working together. And we want to do that same thing with anthropology and sociology. And one of the things I quickly realized working in this area is that it's not an engineering problem. I'd say it's not a single discipline problem. It's a problem that requires all the disciplines coming together. At our conference, Jenna mentioned last October, we awarded the first OU International Water Prize focused on someone doing water and sanitation work in developing countries. Dr. Steve Luby, a medical doctor, was the first winner of that. He started off interested in looking at malaria, but switched into drinking water early in his career, and has focused on that for over a decade now. One of the things he said is the discipline he hires more than any other, he's currently working in Bangladesh, the International Center for Diarrheal Disease Research. Sounds like a very attractive place, so I'm sure people, young students probably flock to want to work on diarrheal disease research, but nonetheless, the thing Steve says the discipline he hires more than any other is anthropology. And here's a medical doctor working on drinking water quality issues, and he says the discipline that's most important is anthropology, understanding how people work, understanding societies, understanding behavior change, and so that's something we're really trying to help our students recognize and get exposed to. And so our classes that I'm teaching this semester is students in an engineering course, but we read about just and lasting change. We read three cups of tea to learn how to make sustainable change in another culture. And we learn about, read the book on the bottom billion, what are the things that trap people in the bottom billion. So a much broader perspective than the typical engineering class.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. I'm going to turn attention for my last question here to the issue of demand from public agencies for academic resources, for academic expertise. And I know many of you have described your interactions with a variety of different public agencies at the district level and at the national level in the countries where you're working. But if you could, let me ask David Kramer and Christine Moe and Melinda Laiturie to just kind of finish up this portion of the discussion by addressing the kind of work that your institutions have done in cooperation with or for government agencies or for international organizations. Tell us a little bit about what works well and what doesn't seem to work well. And let me ask you to just share your thoughts as we move to the next portion of the discussion to tell us, you know, how you think a university consortium organized around WASH issues could better address government or public agency needs, and how you might see the U.S. government supporting university WASH programs. What, you know, what kinds of interactions do you think could be most useful in this end? So let me start with Christine and then ask David Kramer to talk briefly, and then we'll end with Melinda. Thank you.
So we have seen demand from actually quite a few different groups for our help in water sanitation and hygiene issues. And one example is the WHO came to us. They were developing a course for public health professionals in the Central Asian Republics, and they asked us to help them design a course on waterborne diseases and how to set up surveillance for waterborne diseases, because with surveillance, it's easy to say we don't have any water and health problems if you don't look. And so this was to help these countries understand techniques for setting up disease surveillance, looking for outbreaks that may be related to water and sanitation. So that was one example of a course that we developed for WHO. I think that there's also demand for our research and evaluation skills. And one example of that was that UNICEF and the Ministry of Health in El Salvador had built several thousand latrines, dry sanitation facilities, and they had used a couple different designs, but they had never evaluated these. So they asked us to go in and help evaluate their program, and we found that there were striking differences between these different latrine designs. So not all latrines are equal. So we found that some designs were more effective at killing pathogens, were actually safer and had a better health impact than some other designs. And so we took the research results, and we sat down in a face-to-face meeting with the Ministry of Health and with UNICEF and showed them the results so that they had some guidance, some data for decision-making on how to move forward with which types of sanitation facilities to promote. And we've also had requests from foundations. For example, the GE Foundation has asked us and some other foundations to help them set priorities for some of their programs. Where can they get the most bang for the buck? How can they be most effective? Which countries need help with water sanitation and hygiene the most? So we have different demands for different types of skills, but we feel that we are playing a very useful role in providing the evidence base for better decisions and better implementation of WASH programs.
David Kramer.
There are a lot of different sources of funding and public funding that we all have had. Some of the more innovative ones, I think, deal with the universities in other nations. To really be sustainable, was pointed out actually earlier that governments can change, there can be civil unrest, but universities and university extensions, when they rebuild in some of these countries, the coordination with them is very important. And the work of UNESCO, for example, not only has lecturers come from the U.S. to lecture in different universities, and again, that's got to have follow-on, but they also have people from the home continent in different countries go and visit and lecture. And these sort of coordinated efforts are usually a little bit more sustainable. The private industry is also putting a certain amount of effort into educational efforts and sanitation efforts and private foundations as well. I think where we fail very often is with NGOs. There isn't enough sustainable funding for efforts. We talked about the importance of going back to a place. If the funding is not there, a lot of people will drop a project, will drop a community, and not be able to follow on, no matter how much they want to. And that's sort of a perennial problem that many of us face. Lastly, I think it's important to recognize that there are things that we can do as a consortium to help coordinate efforts. I think that by just knowing if you would want to work in Ethiopia, who's working in Ethiopia, what they're doing, to coordinate efforts to get a good web-based site, who are the contact people involved, and how to best coordinate planned or future efforts with the ongoing projects and to do follow-on, I think that there's a certain amount lacking in that, and that's something for the future that we can make great strides in.
Thank you. Melinda.
One key area where we do get a lot of funding from in terms of universities is the National Science Foundation. And National Science Foundation is key in terms of funding basic science. That means that it focuses very much on one type of research that they would like us to do. Now, granted, part of that has to be broader impacts, and all the things that we've talked about address broader impacts, but another key element of NSF is really that it must benefit the U.S., and so we have to be able to target our research in such a way that we're demonstrating benefit to the U.S. while we're doing things in an international environment, and that can be challenging. Part of the problems that we have with our funding agencies is that we have a short funding cycle. We have anywhere from 2 to 5 years that we have to get something done, and then we run out of dollars, and that's difficult in terms of trying to make long-term impact somewhere. We also have efforts to do a lot of international outreach, and I think what's been demonstrated by the panel here is the importance of that the universities are doing things that are relevant. We're doing things that count, and we're doing things that are practical and measurable, and so that we're not this ivory tower, and that's, I think, a really important aspect of the outreach piece of most of our research projects that we do. Another angle that we haven't talked about is the Peace Corps, and some of our institutions have something called the Peace Corps Masters International Program, where it's partnering the Peace Corps students doing their volunteer experience as well as getting a master's degree and going on higher education. So you have a higher trained type of volunteer going out in the field, doing something in a community, and coming back and going through the regular academic channel of then writing it up and having it disseminated in other sorts of venues in terms of a publication. And I think the final area that we can work best in terms of leveraging funding opportunities is in the delivery and dissemination of data and using web-based technologies and geographic information systems to get information out there in a standardized format that makes for better sharing and understanding some of these critical issues that we're addressing here today.
Thank you very much. Thank all of our panelists for sharing their thoughts and their projects and their partnerships with us this afternoon. I'm going to turn now to our question and answer session, but before I do, I wanted to invite David Douglas to introduce. We're very fortunate to have with us Aaron Salzberg, who coordinates water issues at the U.S. Department of State, and I'll ask David to introduce Aaron and invite Aaron to make a few comments before we open the floor for discussion.